the Great. As the columns plodded back westward, things began to unravel. Colder weather set in. Food ran out. The already weakened pack animals collapsed and died, and disease again ravaged the ranks. Much of all that accumulated loot was abandoned, and sensing the weakness of the French, the Russians aggressively began to harass and raid the retreating columns. Especially feared by the French were marauding bands of Cossacks, and the cry that Cossacks had been spotted often would send the men into a panic. Starving soldiers ate their own horses. Then they turned to cats and dogs, and finally to less wholesome fare. One soldier recorded the recipe for a sort of concoction that he labeled Spartan gruel, and this consisted of a mixture of melted snow, a little handful of flour, a bit of axle grease, and finally some gunpowder for seasoning. There are many rumors, some of which are probably true, that desperate soldiers even engaged in cannibalism. By mid-November, the temperatures had dropped to below 0 degrees Fahrenheit. The bitter cold was more than even elite soldiers such as these could be expected to endure. Davout, one of Napoleon's marshals, was moved to declare, "Only men of iron could bear such hardships. It is physically impossible to hold out any longer. Human strength has its limits, and we have gone beyond them." Another general left a vivid description of the sorry state of the army, writing, "The cold, the privations were extreme. The hour of disasters has come upon us. At every step, we were obliged to halt and fight. Cold, hunger, the Cossacks, every scourge was let loose upon us. The army was sinking under the weight of its misfortunes. The road was strewed with the dead. Our sufferings exceeded imagination." Still, the remnants of the French army doggedly struggled onward, retracing their steps back across Russia. And gradually, they drew closer to the border. One major barrier remained in their path, and this was the River Berezina. The Russians wanted to wipe out the French, and so they too now focused on that river as the place to do it. One Russian army was ordered to dash to the western bank of the Berezina and block the French from crossing. Faced with this obstacle, Napoleon finally had a bit of luck. His scouts located a spot where it might be possible to erect some temporary bridges, and so the French diverted to that site without the Russians detecting them. In a stunning and impressive feat of courage and determination, the French engineers labored heroically in the freezing water to quickly build these bridges, and the tattered survivors began to cross. Soon the Russians found out what was happening and arrived, but a fierce rearguard action held them off long enough for most of the French to scramble over the bridges before they were destroyed. The Russians then slacked off in their pursuit. But for the French, their ordeal was not yet over. They still had to stagger on for another 2 weeks through the deepening snow before they reached their initial starting point at the Niemen River. Napoleon did not stay with his dying army, however, but instead, on December 5th, he broke away to return alone to Paris. There, he began attempting to rebuild his shattered military. The last weeks of the abandoned army's march were among the worst. The temperatures dipped to 25 degrees below zero. The food was long gone, and the men were reduced to shambling, frozen, skeletal figures. Even now, so close to the end, many could take no more, and they shot themselves. Also, incidents of cannibalism increased. Finally, the agony ended on December 14th as the survivors reached the city of Vilna, just across the Niemen. The role of combat-ready troops was now down to a mere 10,000. Since many wounded had previously been evacuated, and others would recover later, the number of French troops who survived the expedition was probably around 35,000, with maybe another 50,000 or so Allied soldiers eventually being able to be counted among the living participants. Nevertheless, around 400,000 members of the French army, who had been alive just 6 months earlier, were now dead. The Russians lost a similar number, and when civilian casualties are added in, the total price of Napoleon's attempted invasion of Russia was over 1 million human lives. Napoleon would somehow manage to assemble an army of nearly 200,000 new recruits, but he was scraping the bottom of the manpower barrel. Even more important than sheer numbers, he could never replace all the experienced veterans lost in the Russian snows. Also, the supply of trained cavalrymen and the horses that they rode had both been expended on the Russian expedition. In coming battles, Napoleon would be hamstrung by a severe lack of cavalry. He would continue to fight for another 2 years, but the tide had irreversibly turned, and now he was almost always on the defensive. Emboldened by the disaster in Russia, many of his former allies broke away and joined a pan-European coalition against him. It was only a matter of time before he was brought down, and in due course, after the battles of Leipzig and Waterloo, he was. The mistakes that Napoleon made during this campaign were many. The whole expedition was ill-conceived from the start, and his expectations for how the Russians would behave were completely erroneous. He foolishly appointed his inept brother to an important role, and that decision cost him a chance to wipe out a Russian army early on. At Borodino, his frontal assault tactics were unimaginative and resulted in an indecisive bloodbath. Too prideful to admit error, he allowed himself to be lured onward to Moscow, and once there, he lingered far too long, hoping for a diplomatic victory that it was obvious the Russians just would not grant him. The invasion of Russia proved to be a fatal miscalculation that not only led to Napoleon's downfall, but also blemished his legacy as a brilliant general.
Lecture 13, Afghanistan, Khyber Pass Death Trap.
A cliche of popular novels and movies is a melodramatic scene depicting a badly injured lone survivor of some terrible massacre who stumbles into a military outpost to report the calamity. These sorts of scenes rarely happen in real life. But in 1842, at a dusty fort in the foothills of eastern Afghanistan, just such an incident occurred. On January 13th, 1842, a sentry at the British fort at Jalalabad sighted a lone rider desperately galloping towards him. Upon reaching the fort, both rider and pony collapsed. While the unfortunate pony soon expired from its injuries, the man, although he had suffered knife wounds to his head, shoulder, knee, and hand, would recover. He was a British Army doctor named William Bryden, and he brought news of a truly stunning disaster. The entire British Army of the Indus, 16,000 soldiers and camp followers, had been wiped out by Afghan tribesmen. While attempting to retreat through the mountain passes from Kabul back to India, the whole force had been either slaughtered or captured, and only Dr. Bryden had managed to evade the rampaging Afghan warriors to deliver notice of one of the worst disasters in all of British military history. By the early 19th century, the British East India Company controlled much of the lucrative Indian subcontinent, and they maintained order with what really amounted to private armies, which were composed mainly of native troops commanded by British officers. Meanwhile, Russia was aggressively pushing into Central Asia, and one of the perennial worries of the British was that the Russians would either attempt to invade India through the border zone of Afghanistan, or would use Afghanistan as a base to foment rebellion against the English down in India. Whether or not Russia ever seriously contemplated such actions is debatable. But nevertheless, there was considerable paranoia about Russian plots in Afghanistan. Many among the East India Company's administrators believed that in order to thwart such machinations, they needed to ensure that Afghanistan was under the control of local rulers who were firmly pro-British. In October of 1837, a chance encounter on a desolate mountain road near the border of Iran and Afghanistan seemed to confirm their very worst fears. A British Lieutenant Rawlinson happened to pass by a small band of horsemen who were headed towards Afghanistan. The observant Rawlinson recognized the other riders as Cossacks, and in their midst was a Russian political officer. His suspicions aroused, the lieutenant followed the other party and even attempted to converse with them in a variety of languages, including French, English, Persian, and some local dialects. The Russian officer, who in reality actually knew several of those languages, pretended not to understand Rawlinson very well. But he did admit that he was an official representative of the Russians bearing gifts for the Shah of Persia. The two men smoked a congenial pipe together and then parted and went their separate ways. Rawlinson immediately went to the camp of the Shah and asked what he knew about the Russian. The Shah said that the Russian had been sent to open negotiations with the ruler of Afghanistan. This Russian agent, whose name was Captain Vitkovich, soon arrived at the camp as well. Vitkovich cordially greeted the astonished Rawlinson in fluent French, claiming that his earlier pretense of ignorance was due to the fact that, you know, one had to be careful when encountering strangers in the desert. Realizing that Vitkovich's mission could be the first step of that long-feared Russian campaign to move into Afghanistan, Rawlinson at once set off on an epic 800-mile ride all the way back to his headquarters in Tehran. He made the journey in record time, and he stunned his superiors by announcing that the Russians were already dispatching agents into Afghanistan to suborn the local leaders. The current king of Afghanistan was Dost Muhammad Khan. He had deposed the previous ruler, Shah Shuja, in 1834. The British counterpart in Afghanistan to the Russian Captain Vitkovich was a man named Alexander Burns. And Burns was ordered to sound out Dost Muhammad. Burns, by the way, was a first cousin to the famous poet Robert Burns. And Burns was quite a colorful character in his own right. He had traveled to India as a young man, where he quickly demonstrated an aptitude for picking up different languages, including Persian, Hindustani, and Arabic. Because of his linguistic facility, Burns was employed as a political officer, and he undertook several journeys through what were then little-known areas of the region. Among these was a mission to deliver a gift from the King of England to the ruler of Lahore. And the gift consisted of 5 gigantic English dray horses. These had to be shepherded by Burns hundreds of miles up the Indus River, a feat which he managed to successfully accomplish. He also led a mission to visit Dost Muhammad in Kabul. Sensitive to the strictures of his Islamic hosts, he recorded that when he was asked if he ate pork, he outwardly pretended to be utterly repulsed by the idea. But he later confessed to a very different perspective, writing, "God forgive me for this deception, for I am very fond of bacon, and my mouth waters as I write the word." Burns was infatuated with Afghanistan, and he went away with a highly favorable impression of Dost Muhammad as well. Burns published a book about all of his adventures, which became a bestseller in England, and he became popularly known as Bokhara Burns. His various exploits earned him a knighthood, a gold medal from the Royal Geographical Society, and he was made a fellow of the Royal Society. All this, and he was barely 30 years old. At the end of 1836, Burns was again dispatched to Kabul to try to promote British interests there. And it was shortly afterwards that Vitkovich showed up as well. Although the two men were, in essence, rival spies, they behaved with Victorian decorum towards one another. Burns even invited Vitkovich over for Christmas dinner. While outwardly polite, each man was trying to persuade Dost Muhammad to favor his own nation. Now, in reality, Dost Muhammad seems all along to have been very much a British sympathizer. He seems to have keenly wanted to ally himself with England. Dost Muhammad was also a capable ruler. He was well-liked by the Afghans. He had the enthusiastic recommendation of the British expert on the spot, Burns, and he was eager to side with the British. So, given all this, it seems like it should have been a very simple matter for the British to extend friendship to him and thereby easily secure that crucial frontier against Russia. Unfortunately, it was not to be. 1,500 miles away in Calcutta, Burns' superior, the Governor General of India, who was a man named Lord Auckland, had his own ideas about who should occupy the throne of Afghanistan. Auckland was a very poor choice for Governor General of India. He had little to no knowledge of or really even much interest in India or its rich culture and history. He relied heavily on his political secretary, William McNaughton. McNaughton was a career bureaucrat who was jealous of Burns's rapid rise. Despite never having been to Afghanistan himself, McNaughton urged Auckland to give British support to the former king of Afghanistan, Shah Shuja. Auckland acquiesced, and thus all of Burns's pleas to offer friendship to the eager and competent Dost Muhammad went unanswered. Instead, the British in India began to organize a campaign to depose Dost Muhammad and replace him with Shah Shuja. McNaughton claimed that the Afghans would enthusiastically welcome Shuja's return, when in reality they viewed him as an interloper. The British also claimed that Dost Muhammad would be removed by Shuja's own army, when in fact Shuja had no troops. If Shuja were to be restored, therefore, it would require British soldiers to accomplish it. This entire plan was pure folly. But Auckland had his way, and to Burns' horror, Dost Muhammad was officially denounced by the British, and a British army of 20,000 men was organized and dispatched to remove him and put Shah Shuja on the throne. MacNaughton accompanied the force as political advisor. By the end of August 1839, this powerful army had marched to Kabul. Dost Muhammad had been forced to flee into the wilderness, and Shah Shuja was proclaimed King of Afghanistan. Eventually, Dost Muhammad surrendered himself to the British, and he was sent into exile in India. Auckland and MacNaughton had gotten their way, but the Afghans were not pleased with their new monarch, and they were even less pleased at the foreign armed force that had installed him. Most of the British troops in the expedition then went back to India, but they left behind a garrison of about 5,000 in Kabul. The commanders of the British garrison Kabul then made a terrible tactical decision when, rather than establishing themselves within one of the many available strong fortresses that were located in and around Kabul, instead, they set up a huge, sprawling camp on the outskirts of the city in the middle of an open plain. With a perimeter that was almost 2 miles in length and overlooked by higher ground and having only very low walls for defense, it was a position that would be almost impossible to defend against attack. In perhaps an even more stupid move, the vital food stores for the men were then placed in buildings which were located outside of the main camp. For a while, things seemed calm. Many of the officers brought their wives up from India, and they engaged in a constant round of dinner parties, cricket matches, and socializing. When the army had marched to Kabul, it had been accompanied by a mass of 38,000 camp followers and various servants bearing its baggage. For example, one British general employed no fewer than 260 camels just to carry his own personal possessions. Each officer might have 40 or 50 servants. One British regiment required 2 camels simply to transport its supply of cigars. The arrogance of the British grated on the Afghans, and the ineffectual Shah Shuja was disrespected and widely viewed as just being their lackey. A particular source of resentment to the honor-conscious Afghans were the sexual liaisons that developed between many of the British troops and the Afghan women. And somewhat surprisingly, one of the chief offenders in this regard seems to have been Alexander Burns. With his local knowledge, he really should have known better. But with all of his advice having been completely ignored by his superiors and having been sort of pushed aside by MacNaughton in the role of political advisor, Burns seems to have consoled himself by enjoying the favors of quite a few Afghan women. Meanwhile, one of Dost Muhammad's sons, Akbar Khan, began to agitate for a uprising against the British and Shah Shuja. Akbar Khan was young, energetic, he was charismatic, and he was a natural leader. So he rapidly gained supporters, especially among the very warlike tribesmen of the hills. With resentment growing within the city, and Akbar Khan prowling around outside it, tension between the British and the Afghans steadily ratcheted up. As if things were not looking bad enough for the British, a new officer was now put in charge of the Kabul garrison, who would prove not merely to be suffering from severe physical disabilities, but also to be completely indecisive and ineffectual as a commander. This was Lord William Elphinstone, who at the time of his appointment was almost entirely crippled by gout, to such a degree that he could hardly move. Perhaps even worse, he was in the habit of waffling horribly when asked to make any decision whatsoever. Now, everyone agreed that Elphinstone was extremely polite, often downright affable in a kind of distracted, grandfatherly sort of way. But as a commanding officer, he was a total disaster. This was the man now put in charge of the dangerous tinderbox that Kabul had become. Lieutenant Rawlinson and other experienced men repeatedly submitted reports saying that a rebellion was imminent. But McNaughton steadfastly refused to accept anything that would contradict his own interpretation. His response to one such report managed to be both utterly wrong and incredibly condescending at the same time. He wrote, "I know such rumors are utterly false. I think our prospects are most cheering, and there ought to be little or no difficulty. These people are perfect children, and they should be treated as such." In late 1841, Auckland ordered that the relatively modest subsidies, these were basically bribes, that were being paid to the local chieftains should be slashed. And this misguided economizing measure removed the last incentive restraining the tribesmen. As one observer concluded, "For a few rupees, we raised the whole country against us." On November 2nd, prompted by an incident with a local girl, a small mob gathered outside Burns's house, and then they attacked it, setting fire to the gates. Word of this reached the main British camp less than half an hour away, and a number of officers urged immediately sending troops to rescue Burns and to quell the incipient riot. But true to form, Elphinstone dithered for a while and then did nothing. Burns had about a dozen soldiers in his house, and as the crowd grew larger and more violent, they resisted stoutly. A firefight broke out, and with no aid arriving from the camp, the attackers grew bolder, eventually storming the house and slaughtering the inhabitants, including Alexander Burns. His body was mutilated and just left in the street. The shooting and smoke were clearly audible and visible from the camp, but the 5,000 troops there sat idle while Burns and his party were killed. Now there was a full-fledged uprising, and thousands joined in. As one British officer commented, "When 300 men would have been sufficient in the morning to quell the disturbance, 3,000 would not have been adequate in the afternoon." At the camp, McNaughton refused to acknowledge the seriousness of the situation, and Elphinstone decided to wait until the next morning before taking any action. By then, an estimated 50,000 had joined. Over the next several days, the rebels captured other British outposts, including those containing the food and water stores. This was a vast stash which could have fed the army for 3 years. Within the camp, however, there were only 2 days' worth of supplies, and this put the British in a desperate situation. The Afghans surrounded the camp, and from the high ground overlooking it, began sniping and picking off the now starving British soldiers. Finally, the British attempted a foray out of the camp to drive the Afghans from the high ground. But it ended in chaos, with over 300 men killed and nothing accomplished. Soon after, Akbar Khan himself arrived to take command of the rebels, and he tightened the siege on the camp. The British now decided that their only hope was to arrange with Akbar Khan to let them withdraw from Kabul and go back to India. A meeting was set up between Akbar and McNaughton, at which Akbar promised to allow the British to retreat unharmed through the Khyber Passes and to provide them with food and an escort. In return, Dost Muhammad would be released to reclaim the throne. Akbar did not trust McNaughton, and sure enough, McNaughton tried to cut a secret deal with Akbar to betray some of the other warlords. Akbar revealed this duplicity to his fellow chiefs, and at another meeting that was held to supposedly work out the details, Akbar's men seized McNaughton. A scuffle broke out, and he and the other Englishmen were killed. Amazingly, once again, the British made no attempt to avenge their slain officers, and instead just sat in the camp. McNaughton's severed head was paraded through the streets of Kabul. Despite this, the British went ahead with plans to retreat. And on January 6, 1842, with snow a foot deep on the ground, the army departed. There were about 3,800 Indian troops, 700 European soldiers, and 12 to 14,000 camp followers. The escort that Akbar Khan had promised to provide to ensure their safe passage was nowhere to be found. They had to go about 90 miles to reach the British fort at Jalalabad. The disorganized, unwieldy, and heavily burdened column plodded out. Shortly after leaving, Elphinstone had second thoughts, and so he ordered a halt and then couldn't make up his mind whether they should continue or not. Tribesmen began to snipe at the column, and most of the cannons, as well as the meager supplies that they had, were abandoned in the resulting panic. Night fell, bringing with it freezing temperatures. The column had covered on the first day just 5 of the 90 miles. The next morning, many were found frozen to death, and with painful slowness, the column crawled forward under a constant hail of fire from the harassing Afghans. Elphinstone again called a premature halt in mid-afternoon at the entrance to the Khord Pass. Akbar Khan sent a message saying that if the British would halt and provide him with hostages, he would arrange for them to get through the pass safely. And astonishingly, Elphinstone accepted this at face value. So he settled down in the snow to wait after barely managing another 5 miles. The wretched survivors spent a second torturous night huddling in the snow. In the words of one of them, it was a night of starvation, cold, exhaustion, death. Pushing on, they finally reached the pass, only to find that Akbar Khan had delayed them so that hordes of tribesmen could gather in the narrow confines of the pass and subject the column to a withering fire from their long muskets. Crammed together, the British and their followers were mown down. 3,000 of them were killed. The survivors spent another dismal night at the top of the pass, and a blizzard showed up to further add to their wretchedness. They again set off, but after only 1 mile, Elphinstone called another halt. This time, many simply ignored him. Things were so desperate that Elphinstone decided that the only chance of survival for the remaining wives and children of the officers was to turn them over to the mercy of Akbar Khan. So they were gathered up and delivered to him. The number of soldiers was probably less than 1,000 by this point, and safety was still 70 miles distant. By January 11th, only a couple thousand remained of the 17,000 who had set out. Akbar Khan now sent another message claiming that he wished to meet with Elphinstone and the other senior officers. The British again agreed, and once they had arrived in Akbar's camp, he announced that they were all his hostages, and they would not be allowed to return to the column. Those left behind attempted a night march to try and escape their tormentors. It ended in catastrophe, when they ran into a thorny barrier that had been erected across their path in the narrows of another mountain pass. In the dark, they struggled with the prickly thorns, and many of them were shot as they tried to climb over the obstacle. Only a few made it over the thorn wall, while the rest were all massacred. The largest group was a contingent of about 65 men of the 44th Foot. They were pursued and finally caught on a hilltop near Gandamak, where they formed into a square and made a heroic last stand. They all went down fighting, and all of them but a few were killed. A small party of horsemen also broke free, and this included Dr. Bryden. In a series of skirmishes, all of his companions were slain or captured, so that he alone made it to the fort at Jalalabad. From start to finish, what is now termed the First Afghan War by the British had been an unmitigated disaster. The paranoia about Russian plots was probably unfounded. Auckland's decision to depose Dost Muhammad was just plain wrong. Its execution was ill-conceived. The sighting and arrangement of the British garrison's camp at Kabul was criminally inept. Macnaghten consistently and seriously misjudged the Afghans. Elphinstone's indecisiveness was crippling. The lack of a swift response to Burns's death doomed the British. The degree of gullibility of the British when negotiating with Akbar Khan was stunning. And finally, the retreat itself was horribly mismanaged at virtually every stage. As for the fates of some of the characters in this lecture, just 1 week after returning to St. Petersburg from his Afghan mission, the Russian agent, Captain Vitkovich, was found shot dead in his hotel room. Beside his body was a oddly terse suicide note, and all the papers from his mission had been piled up and burnt. Whether his mysterious death was a suicide or, as many suspected, a murder, remains uncertain. Lieutenant Rawlinson is credited with having come up with the famous phrase, the Great Game, which is used to refer to the struggle between Russia and England in Central Asia during the 19th century. He also acquired fame for deciphering Persian cuneiform by studying the trilingual Behistun inscription carved onto the side of a mountain by the ancient Persian king Darius. Elphinstone died while still a prisoner of Akbar Khan. The British officers' wives who survived were treated courteously by Akbar, and eventually they were released. Akbar Khan himself only lived a few more years, dying abruptly in his late 20s. It's commonly believed that he was poisoned. Dost Muhammad not only regained his throne and ruled until 1863, but he expanded his empire, all the while maintaining good relations with the British as he had initially desired. He was buried in a substantial marble tomb, and his descendants continued to rule in Afghanistan all the way up until the 1970s.
Lecture 14, Crimea, Charge of the Light Brigade.
The Crimean War of 1853 to 1856, which was fought between Russia and a coalition consisting of England, France, and Turkey, has lapsed into relative obscurity today. It deserves to be remembered for a number of reasons, however. It's sometimes been called the First Modern War, and it introduced a number of technological innovations that were to play important roles in later, better-known conflicts, such as the American Civil War and World War I. The Crimean War featured the first tactical employment of railways. It was the first European war to be recorded by the new medium of photography. It made widespread use of the strategy of trench warfare, and it was the first war to be reported live to audiences back home via the electric telegraph. The Crimean War made a hero out of Florence Nightingale and her work, as well as that of other less famous nurses such as Mary Seacole. It also led to the establishment of modern nursing methods and practices. Leo Tolstoy was inspired by and drew upon his own experiences in the Crimean War to write his great epic novel, War and Peace. The conflict even gave rise to no fewer than three distinctive types of clothing, all of which were named after people or places in the war. Despite all this, probably the single most famous aspect of the Crimean War is a minor incident that occurred during it, which has gained a reputation as simultaneously one of the most glorious moments in the history of warfare and one of the greatest military blunders of all. This was the Charge of the Light Brigade, memorialized in Alfred Lord Tennyson's poem of the same name. This charge, in which the British light cavalry mistakenly attacked the wrong target and as a result was effectively destroyed, was the concluding episode in a whole day's worth of encounters, which are collectively known as the Battle of Balaclava. The charge is also one of the most memorable instances of a failure of communication on the battlefield, and it shows the dire consequences that can result from such an error. Perhaps appropriately, for what was a strange war in many respects, the immediate cause of the Crimean War was a bizarre international squabble over who controlled the keys to a door in the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. At this point in time, the Holy Lands were part of the Turkish Ottoman Empire, which was ruled over by the Sultan in Istanbul. Greek Orthodox monks controlled the keys to the main door of this church, while Catholic monks were only given the keys to a side door. This was a slight, which was a source of great resentment by them. The Emperor of France, who was looking for a way to assert his power, decided to insist that the Latin monks be given the main door keys. He justified this demand by invoking an ancient title he had, which was Protector of the Latin Church in the Holy Lands. This title had been granted to French monarchs centuries before. Meanwhile, in a similar attempt to enhance his status, the Tsar of Russia had proclaimed himself guardian of the rights of Eastern Orthodox Christians. And so he now challenged the claims of the French king. The poor Ottoman Sultan, who was caught in the middle of this international power struggle, eventually yielded to the French demands. And by doing so, he enraged the Russians. Tensions escalated, leading to a military clash between the Russian and the Ottoman Empire. And war was declared. Naturally, France then joined in on the side of the Turks, and bound by a treaty that they had previously signed, the British were compelled to come to the defense of the Ottomans as well. While all of this may sound a little bit silly, the real underlying roots of this war were the declining power of the Ottoman Empire, which famously was known as the sick man of Europe. And it was also caused by the chief European nation's desire to prevent their rivals from potentially benefiting or gaining key territory from the anticipated breakup of the ailing Ottoman Empire. It had been a long-standing ambition of the Russians to extend their naval power into the Mediterranean Sea from their bases on the Crimean Peninsula in the Black Sea. This was a development that was feared by the French as well as the British. Accordingly, the Allies decided to direct their efforts towards neutralizing the main Crimean Russian naval base, which was located at Sevastopol. A large expeditionary force of French and British soldiers was landed in the Crimea. Several battles were fought, and the harbor of Sevastopol was besieged. The whole endeavor was rather poorly planned and executed. The supplies were inadequate, sanitation measures were appallingly negligent, and, not surprisingly, disease ran rampant through the ranks. The result was that men died in the tens of thousands. In fact, 90% of the deaths ultimately suffered by British troops in the Crimean War would be due to disease rather than enemy action. As part of this campaign, on October 25th, 1854, the Battle of Balaclava was fought. The battle unfolded in several stages, the last of which would be the charge of the Light Brigade. But it began with an attack by the Russians against some fortified redoubts containing Turkish troops and a few cannons. This row of redoubts guarded the British supply lines, and the goal of the Russian attack was to try to cut the British off from their supply depot. The assault began well for the Russians. They overran a number of the redoubts and expelled the Turkish troops there. The overall attack, however, was subsequently blunted and stopped. And this happened in a celebrated incident in which a line of British Highlanders fended off a Russian charge. It was an occurrence which was immortalized when they were labeled the Thin Red Line. Then a bold uphill counterattack by the British Brigade of Heavy Cavalry halted another major Russian advance. Much of the subsequent events of the Battle of Balaclava hinge on the personalities of some key British commanders who participated. These included Lord Raglan, who was the commander-in-chief. He had been observing the battle from a high rocky outcrop that rose nearly 700 feet above the level of the surrounding valleys. Raglan was a veteran of the Napoleonic Wars. He had even lost an arm in that conflict. But his previous posts had all been administrative in nature. The Crimean War would be the very first time that he would be directly overseeing actual combat operations. The man in overall charge of the British cavalry forces, which consisted of a heavy brigade and a light brigade, was the Earl of Lucan. Lucan's subordinate and the commander of the light brigade itself was the Earl of Cardigan. Despite the fact that Lucan had married Cardigan's sister, the two men completely and thoroughly despised one another. This was a situation that obviously did not facilitate smooth cooperation between them. Cardigan was very much the arrogant and aloof aristocrat. During the Crimean War, he did not even live with his men, but instead he slept and ate on his luxurious personal yacht, which was anchored just offshore. There he could drink champagne and dine on fine meals, which were prepared for him by his French chef, whom he'd brought along. He was also infamous for bullying his own men. Cardigan once had one of his own officers arrested because the unfortunate man had ordered wine in the mess rather than the champagne which Cardigan had dictated. And somehow Cardigan interpreted this as insubordinate behavior. The captured redoubts were located on a slight ridge known as the Causeway Heights. And this separated two valleys, one which lay to the north and one to the south of the heights. The Russians had fortified the sides of the North Valley with batteries of cannon, and yet another line of cannons was positioned across the far end of this valley. Up on his hilltop, Raglan was greatly annoyed by these minor Russian successes in overrunning the redoubts. He wanted to counterattack, but the only troops ready to hand were the two cavalry contingents of the light and the heavy brigades. Now, conventional military wisdom dictated that cavalry should be used in conjunction with infantry. So he waited impatiently for the infantry to arrive on the scene. After a while, when they still had not appeared, the exasperated Raglan decided to go ahead and order the cavalry alone to attempt to drive the Russians from the Causeway Heights and from the captured redoubts all by themselves. This was not an entirely unreasonable goal, and against such scattered infantry targets, the cavalry could reasonably expect success. He sent a message to Lucan which read, "Cavalry to advance and take advantage of any opportunity to recover the heights. they will be supported by the infantry, which had been ordered to advance on two fronts. Upon receiving this order, Lucan moved the light brigade to the mouth of the North Valley, while the heavy brigade remained in the South Valley. However, he interpreted the message as meaning that he should not attack until the infantry at last came up in support. And so he and his men all settled down to wait for them. While the cavalry were waiting at the mouths of the valleys, up on the ridge, Raglan grew increasingly angry with what he perceived as the willful inaction of Lucan's cavalry. His frustration reached a boiling point when one of his aides claimed to have spotted Russian horse teams getting ready to haul away the cannons that they had captured in the redoubts. While not that important from a purely tactical standpoint, losing any of one's cannons to the enemy was symbolically regarded as a huge disgrace. Given the distance, there is also some doubt whether that aide could actually have perceived anything more definite than maybe some Russian horses moving around. And the Russians themselves later denied that they actually had any intent whatsoever to carry off the guns at that point in time. Nevertheless, Raglan took that report at face value, and he decided that he had to do something to prevent it. So, he drafted another message to Lucan that read, "Lord Raglan wishes the cavalry to advance rapidly to the front. Follow the enemy and try to prevent the enemy carrying away the guns." It is clear that Raglan intended this order as a follow-up to the previous one, which, remember, had named the Causeway Heights as the target. But in the heat of the moment, with his temper up, he didn't specify this clearly in the second message. A courier was handed the order, and as was standard practice, the courier was given verbal clarification of it as well. That should have forestalled any confusion. But just as the man was about to depart, Raglan spotted a certain Captain Nolan loitering nearby and said, "No, send Nolan." Nolan was renowned as being one of the swiftest horsemen in the army, and apparently Raglan thought that employing him would ensure that the order was delivered as quickly as possible. Nolan eagerly grabbed the message and spurred his horse down the steep escarpment towards Lucan. As Nolan dashed away from him, Raglan shouted out after him, "Tell Lord Lucan that the cavalry is to attack immediately." The decision to send Nolan was another terrible error. Nolan had not gotten the careful additional verbal briefing that the other messenger had. And even worse, Nolan was notoriously impetuous and hot-tempered. He was also an especially outspoken advocate of using cavalry in an aggressive manner. He had actually been openly critical of Lucan for what he, Nolan, regarded as his overly timid handling of the cavalry. So Nolan stormed up to Lucan and rather imperiously delivered the fateful message. Lucan did not realize that this message was intended as a follow-up to the earlier one concerning the Russians in the redoubts on the Causeway Heights. And so he was confused as to what target he was now meant to attack. The message directed him to prevent the enemy from carrying away cannons. But from his position low down on the plain, Lucan could not see the guns in the redoubts that Raglan intended him to attack. Puzzled by all this, he asked Nolan, "Attack what? What guns, sir? Where and what to do?" While Lucan may have been a bit slow in not connecting the two messages, asking for clarification from the messenger was absolutely the right thing to do, This was the very reason that such messengers were normally given verbal briefings by the commander-in-chief when they were assigned orders to deliver. But Nolan had not received these verbal directions. And additionally, his quick temper and his own deep personal dislike of Raglan caused him now to respond in a heated manner that really verged on insolence. He contemptuously shouted back, "There, my lord, there is your enemy, there are your guns." And he accompanied these words with a vague wave of his arm towards the Russian lines. The only guns that Lukin could actually see were the Russian batteries at the far end of the North Valley. And so Lukin now decided that these must be the target that he was being ordered to attack. Accordingly, he went to Cardigan and told him that the Light Brigade was to charge down the North Valley and assault the Russian cannons at the far end. This was clearly a near-suicidal proposition, as the vulnerable horsemen would be completely exposed to fire, not only from the cannons at the far end, but also from all of the batteries and troops which lined the right and the left sides of that valley. Cardigan pointed this out, but Lukin simply responded, "I cannot help that. It is Lord Raglan's positive order that the Light Brigade is to attack the enemy." And that was the end of the discussion. Here, the deep-seated personal animosity between these two men seemed to have resulted in yet another failure in communication. When presented with such an obviously nonsensical order, two such senior commanders should have put their heads together and figured out what was really intended, or at least sought clarification. But trapped within a self-imposed and archaic honor system that demanded the bare minimum of interaction with one social enemy, Lukin and Cardigan confined themselves to this rather terse and unhelpful exchange. The stage was now irrevocably set for the Light Brigade to fling itself down the North Valley right into the teeth of the Russian defenses. They would have to advance for over a mile across the valley floor while exposed to enemy cannon fire from three sides. Debate has raged ever since regarding who was to blame for the Light Brigade charging the wrong target. Somewhere in the chain of communication, from Raglan to Nolan to Lukin to Cardigan, the meaning of the order had been lost. All four men have been singled out by various commentators as bearing the greatest share of the fault. Raglan is criticized for drafting an unclear order and for sending it via an improperly briefed messenger who had a personal axe to grind against Lukin. Nolan has been blamed for being unclear, hasty, and provocative in his interaction with Lukin, and also for giving a misleading gesture by waving his arm in the direction of the valley. Lukin is censured for failing to put the messages together and not demanding better information from Nolan. And finally, Cardigan is faulted for blindly obeying what should have been a self-evidently illogical order, and also for allowing his personal animosity for Lukin to prevent the two commanders from properly discussing or analyzing it. In reality, probably they all deserve to share the blame. And collectively, this sequence is a textbook case of how not to issue clear directives on a battlefield. Whoever was at fault, the roughly 650 men of the Light Brigade now set off at a trot into the North Valley, with Cardigan at their head. Since they had to traverse over a mile, they did not gallop until the very end.